content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading this week from the February 15th, 2019 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows a playground scene again, and this time we've got a seesaw, kind of an old-fashioned seesaw. It's painted blue, and it's tilted completely in one direction. And on the bottom of the seesaw are, that's Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and Kamala Harris, all weighing it down, and they have kind of, startled looks on their face. The title of the magazine this week is A Leftward Lurch: Are Democrats Going Too Far on Health Care, Abortion, and Taxes? And we've got a few stories on that, but we'll start with this main story. Virginia Democrats' Blackface and Sex Scandals. What happened? Virginia's State House was in chaos this week after Governor Ralph Northam defied fellow Democrats' demands to resign over a racist photo in his medical school yearbook, while his possible successor, Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax, denied an allegation he'd sexually assaulted a woman in 2004. The next in line for the governor's office, Attorney General Mark Herring, confessed that he had worn blackface as a 19-year-old college student in 1980, when he dressed as a rapper for a party. "It's a mess," said Democratic State Senator Lionel Spruill. Northam, 59, initially apologized for appearing in the photo on his 1984 yearbook page, which shows a man in blackface standing next to someone in Ku Klux Klan robes. He didn't specify which costume he was wearing. Northam backtracked the next day, saying he wasn't in the photo. But he did confess to wearing blackface that same year to portray Michael Jackson at a dance contest. Democrats in Virginia and across the country quickly called for Northam to resign, including most declared 2020 presidential candidates, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, both of Virginia's U.S. senators, and the Congressional Black Caucus. Meanwhile, Vanessa Tyson, a politics professor at Scripps College in California, released a statement in which she accused Fairfax of assaulting her at a hotel during the 2004 Democratic National Convention. A self-described proud Democrat, Tyson said Fairfax forced her to perform a sex act and she cried and gagged. Fairfax called the allegation a smear and said the encounter was 100% consensual. What the editorial said. Northam must resign, said the Virginian pilot. He ran for governor in 2017 on the promise of providing a steady hand and being the adult in the room. Northam now looks anything but. His blackface shame was no childish indiscretion. He was 24 when the yearbook was published and should have known the getup's connection to Virginia's ugly racist past. If Northam wants to heal these wounds, he should do so away from the governor's office. Whether Northam is telling the truth hardly matters, said the Wall Street Journal. For Democrats, racism has become the default charge for any GOP policy they dislike on crime, immigration, education, the environment, you name it. And so the Virginia governor must be sacrificed to preserve the weapon for use against other Republicans. Northam might want Democrats to show mercy now for errors of his youth, but that isn't the Democratic Party that made him governor. What the columnist said. Democrats have no choice but to show zero tolerance, said Domenico Montanaro in NPR.org. To claim the moral high ground in the Trump era, they simply can't afford to accommodate racially insensitive politicians, such as Northam, or those accused of sexual misconduct, such as former Senator Al Franken. Many Republicans have joined Democrats in calling for Northam's ouster, said Charles Sykes in TheBulwark.com. But how can the GOP muster the chutzpah after Roy Moore, Trump's Access Hollywood tape, and Charlottesville? If they can swallow accusations of pedophilia, sexual assault, and sympathy for white nationalism, what gives them the right to now suddenly develop scruples over a photo from 1984? The furor over Northam's photo says a lot about where our culture stands on matters of mercy, said Ben Shapiro in NationalReview.com. Let's be honest. Northam did something reprehensible 35 years ago, but then lived a professionally and personally meritorious life. Does that not count? Is repentance simply not possible in our outraged culture? The answer would seem to be decidedly no, and that's a tragedy for a civilization founded partly on the notion of repentance as a means of self-betterment. Maybe we could forgive Northam if he appeared genuinely sorry, said Matt Ford in NewRepublic.com. But he has displayed a Trumpian lack of shame and is even following Trump's survival strategy from the Access Hollywood scandal. Trump admitted to serial sexual assault in that tape, but resisted Republican calls to step aside as the GOP nominee during the closing weeks of 2016 election. He now sits in the Oval Office. Northam believes that such stubbornness will also help him cling to power. His lack of civic virtue is no less disqualifying than the scandal itself. And before we leave this page, we'll read one of the "It Wasn't All Bad" items. When temperatures dropped to minus 26 degrees Fahrenheit in Chicago last week, a local real estate agent helped provide dozens of homeless people with a warm place to stay. Worried about conditions at a tent camp in the city, Candace Payne used her credit card to pay for 20 rooms at a hotel at $70 a night. "I had to do something," she said. Payne asked on social media for volunteers to help transport the homeless and triggered a flood of donations, with people offering cash and restaurants pledging food. Eventually, 60 hotel rooms were secured for 100 homeless who were housed and fed for 5 days. "I am a regular person," Payne said. "We can all do this together." Controversy of the week: Medicare for all. Will it help or hurt Democrats in 2020? Healthcare should be Democrats' strongest issue heading into 2020, said David Lenart in the New York Times. Instead, it's turning into an unforced error that could badly damage their chances of winning. The problem is Medicare for all. This snappy shorthand phrase for single-payer health care has caught the imagination of the party's base and polls very well, 56% approval with the general public. But as Senator Kamala Harris found out last week, the devil's in the details. Asked in a CNN town hall how Medicare for All bill she's co-sponsoring with Senator Bernie Sanders would affect employer-provided private health insurance, Harris breezily confirmed that it would eliminate all of that. The swift and negative reaction was hardly a surprise, said Rich Lowry in the New York Post. At least 150 million Americans, or more than half of the adult population, get private health insurance through their employers, and about 80% of them say they like their current coverage. When people learn that Medicare for all means abolishing private insurance, support plummets to 37%. After the backlash, Harris quickly walked back her remark, saying she might be open to a more incremental plan. This is undoubtedly the first of many unpleasant encounters between the Democrats' signature campaign issue and political reality. Medicare for all is not a fantasy, said Dean Baker in CNN.com. Many developed nations, including Canada, France, and Denmark, have successful single-payer systems. True, their taxes are higher, but people are no longer charged premiums, co-pays, or deductibles. Because of the efficiencies only possible under single-payer, these countries spend half as much per person on health care annually, about $5,000, as we do here, while enjoying longer life expectancies. After the epic struggle to pass and defend Obamacare, said Eric Levitz in NYMag.com, nobody thinks Medicare for All is going to be easy. In fact, it will face enormous, well-financed opposition from the insurance industry, big pharma, and doctor and hospital groups. But that doesn't mean single payer isn't worth fighting for. It's a strategic way to move the ball down the field toward genuinely universal health care. Not to be too dramatic, said Tiana Lowe in WashingtonExaminer.com, but compelling the U.S. to adopt socialized medicine would kill people. To be remotely affordable, even lowball estimates put the cost at $32.6 trillion over a decade. Hospitals and physicians would have to accept reimbursement rates roughly 40% lower than today's. This would create an exodus of physicians from the field and deter bright young people from entering it, creating a serious physician shortage. Let's not be too envious of our neighbor to the north, said Jim Garrity in NationalReview.com. More than a million Canadians are waiting for treatment at any given time. Only 25% of U.S. citizens still favor Medicare for All when told it would mean longer wait times. Americans don't really care about single-payer per se, said Catherine Rampell in the Washington Post. What they want is universal, affordable coverage that doesn't leave them begging on GoFundMe sites for their kids' insulin. Heading into 2020, Democrats should simply pledge themselves to achieve that goal, whether it's through Medicare for All or a more modest step, such as a public option to buy into Medicare and Medicaid that would coexist with private insurance plans. Health care can still be a winning issue for Democrats, but they mustn't let the perfect become the enemy of the good. This short only in America item goes along with the discussion of health care. A career criminal robbed a bank in Wisconsin because he'd been told the state's jails offer superior health care. While serving time in a New Jersey jail, William Gallagher, 68, heard fellow inmates raving about Wisconsin's prison health care. Upon his release, says his lawyer, the Vietnam War veteran robbed a Milwaukee bank with the sole intention of going to jail. Prosecutors James Griffin called the case a sad comment on health care in America. And this is right beside our good week, bad week item. It was a good week for natural beauty, with a White House denial that President Trump uses a self-tanning cream to achieve his year-round orange skin tone. A Trump aide said he owes his distinctive glow to the equally distinctive white patches around his eyes to good genes. It was a good week for self-defense after a trail runner in Colorado Park was attacked by a mountain lion and strangled the predator to death with his bare hands. In the event of a lion attack, said a state wildlife official, you need to do anything in your power to fight back. And it was a good week for New England sports fans after the Patriots won another Super Bowl, the 11th championship won by Massachusetts-based football, baseball, basketball, and hockey franchises since 2002. But it was a bad week for the B word. After former Starbucks CEO and aspiring presidential contender Howard Schultz urged Americans to stop using the ugly slur billionaire, Schultz suggested that people who have acquired unimaginable riches should be referred to as people of means or people of wealth. It was a bad week for Karl Marx, the architect of communism, whose tomb in London's Highgate Cemetery was defaced by an anonymous vandal wielding a hammer. Regardless of what anyone thinks about Marx's philosophy, said Ian Dugavel of Friends of Highgate Cemetery Trust, I just think it's an appalling thing to do. And finally, it was a bad week for gratitude. After an Indian man announced he was suing his parents for bringing him into this world without his consent. Raphael Samuel of Mumbai said his parents selfishly had me for their joy and pleasure and that he didn't ask to exist. And before we leave the page, a boring but important item. Former Coke official shapes EPA water policy. A former Koch Industries official is leading research at Environmental Protection Agency that could have major financial implications for his ex-employer, Politico.com reported this week. After serving for 8 years as Koch's lead expert on water and chemical regulations, David Dunlap was hired by the EPA in October. He almost immediately began working on research that will shape how the government regulates a class of chemicals that's contaminated drinking water across the country. Koch, which could face significant cleanup costs, said Dunlap's portfolio at the company did not include the chemicals under review, known as PFAs. Koch's subsidiary, Georgia-Pacific, already faces a lawsuit over PFAs linked to a Michigan paper mill. Our briefing page article is titled, The Other China. Taiwan's separate status, said China's leader Xi Jinping, is a wound to the Chinese national left by history. Is a crisis coming? What does China want? China has always considered Taiwan its territory, and reunification is an almost sacred cause. Tensions across the Taiwan Strait have led to conflict or near conflict at least three times since 1949, and they are ratcheting up again. Chinese leaders have been alarmed since Taiwanese President Tsai Ing-wen of the Democratic Progressive Party was elected in 2016. While she doesn't explicitly call for independence, she has told Beijing it must respect the island nation's sovereignty and the wishes of the Taiwanese people. In a major speech last month, Chinese President Xi Jinping warned that Taiwan would eventually be incorporated one way or another. We make no promise to abandon the use of force, he said. That the two sides of the strait are still not fully unified is a wound to the Chinese nation left by history. Xi said that Taiwan's rights could be protected under the one country, two systems approach adopted when Hong Kong was absorbed in 1997. Tsai pointedly responded that Taiwan, a free society with a boisterous democracy, was not interested in being absorbed by the mainland. She said Hong Kong's experience shows that rule from Beijing leads to a loss of freedom, rule of law, and human rights. When was Taiwan part of China? Taiwan, 110 miles from the mainland, was inhabited by Austronesian-speaking Aborigines before being annexed by the Qing Dynasty in 1683. Japan captured it and ruled it from 1895 to 1945 when Chiang Kai-shek, the Chinese nationalist leader, took it back in the name of Post-Imperial Republic of China. In 1949, Chiang's Kuomintang lost China's civil war to Mao Zedong's communist and fled to Taiwan, which inherited the Republic of China name. While on the mainland, Mao declared the People's Republic of China. Each government insisted it represented all of China. Washington took Taiwan's side, seeing it as a bulwark against communism during the Cold War. Taiwan, as the Republic of China, represented China at the United Nations until 1971. How was Taiwan governed? For decades, it was authoritarian, just as China is now. Chiang's party, the Kuomintang, KMT, imposed martial law until 1987, imprisoning tens of thousands of dissidents and executing some 4,000. Yet Taiwan also grew rich. Its economy exploded in the 1960s, until by the early 2000s it led the world in production of computer equipment and bicycles. After Chiang died in 1975, Taiwan began to evolve from a one-party state controlled by the KMT into a thriving democracy of 23 million people. It held free elections in 1992 and had its first partisan transition in 2000, when the opposition Democratic Progressive Party took power. Last year, Taiwan increased its use of direct democracy by adopting one of the most citizen-friendly systems for ballot initiatives and referendums in the world. How are relations with China? Trade is booming, but diplomatic relations are very tense. The KMT officially favors eventual reunification. The DPP, which is currently in power again, leans toward eventual independence. Taiwanese today have a strong sense of Taiwanese national identity. In a survey last month, 75% of Taiwanese said they oppose one country, two systems. But Beijing continues to insist that there is only one China, which includes Taiwan. What is the U.S. role? Washington no longer has official relations with Taiwan, but that is largely a diplomatic fiction. It is still a major ally. Early in the Korean War, when Mao was threatening to invade Taiwan, President Harry Truman ordered U.S. forces to protect the island, and Washington has implicitly guaranteed its safety ever since. A rift came in 1972 when the U.S. established relations with Beijing and acceded to the Chinese demand that Taiwan surrender its U.N. seat. In 1979, with U.S. businesses eager to get access to the vast Chinese market, President Jimmy Carter agreed to open full diplomatic relations with China and accepted Beijing's condition that the U.S. officially sever relations with Taiwan. Congress, though, objected to this treatment of a long-term ally and passed the Taiwan Relations Act, which offers a qualified commitment to support Taiwan's self-defense. Since then, the U.S. has supplied vast amounts of weaponry to Taiwan, $15 billion worth over the past decade. What led to the current tension? China fears that the U.S. is conspiring with Taiwan on its dream to be truly independent, a part of the growing great power competition between Beijing and Washington. President Trump angered Beijing right after his election by telephoning President Tsai, a direct communication that overturned four decades of diplomatic practice since the 1979 break in relations. Exacerbating the tension, Congress last year unanimously passed the Taiwan Travel Act, which allows senior officials to visit between Taipei and Washington. In a show of both irritation and force, China has stepped up military drills and sent an aircraft carrier and other vessels through the strait. In response, U.S. warships have patrolled the waters off Taiwan. A new crisis could be triggered by any of the three parties, said Professor Ji Dali of Peking University, and would be a losing proposition for all sides. And we'll move into some of the best columns of the week, starting with two from the U.S. First, Hispanics actually are assimilating. Veteran TV anchor Tom Brokaw apologized last week for advising Hispanic Americans to work harder on assimilation and to make sure all their kids are speaking English. The real problem with Brokaw's comment was not that it was offensive, said Noah Smith. It was that it was factually wrong. A 2016 Pew survey found that 80% of Hispanics ages 18 to 25 speak only English or are bilingual. Second-generation Hispanics speak English at the same rate as second-generation European immigrants. As Hispanic families work hard to realize the American dream, their household income is steadily climbing to 74% of white households. Their economic mobility is very high. Perhaps the ultimate act of assimilation is intermarriage, which is proceeding at a dizzying pace. Nearly 60% of third-generation Hispanic Americans marry someone who isn't Hispanic. Among fourth-generation Hispanic Americans, 56% no longer even identify as Hispanic. These facts won't allay the resentment of people who actually fear Hispanic assimilation and the influence it will have on our melting pot American culture. But make no mistake, Hispanics are following the same path blazed by previous waves of Italian, Irish, Polish, German, Jewish, and other immigrants. And our second column actually comes from the News and Observer here in Raleigh by Eric Johnson. How Facebook is ruining public life. Google and Facebook are killing local newspapers and badly damaging American public life, said Eric Johnson. The internet giants vacuumed out more than $60 billion in advertising revenue in 2018. Dollars that once went to newspapers and sustained local reporters all over the country. Those reporters covered town council meetings, tax increases, zoning changes, and state capitals. But as local newspapers die by the hundreds, those reporters are no longer on the beat, and decisions get made in the dark. The loss of engagement with local civics and decision-making, I think, is contributing mightily to the sense of frustration so many of us feel with politics and public life. On the local level, there are problems you can actually fix, and political participation by ordinary people can make a big difference. Not so on the national level, where divisive problems like immigration and the Mueller investigation are endlessly repackaged as cheap entertainment by the national media, to the exhaustion of everyone. Your community is not your Facebook contacts, it's where you live. We'd all be happier if we paid more attention to local politics and less to Facebook. This column comes from Sweden. Don't let country folk fall behind. Sweden ignores its rural folk at its peril, said Daniel Sweden. Most Swedes are urbanites. Nearly 15% of our entire population lives in Stockholm. So perhaps it's no surprise that most government spending goes toward the needs of cities. But our small town population is feeling left behind. In the past 3 decades, nearly half our towns have seen drops in population. That means that shops, employment offices, and residential buildings are left empty, while buses and trains just pass by. A dwindling town also has a shrinking tax base, leaving less money for services. That breeds resentment. After a blizzard, city dwellers wake up to plowed streets and cleared sidewalks and can walk a block to get milk. Rural residents, meanwhile, find themselves snowed in and stranded. With health care and education costs continuing to rise, rural communities will be stretched further, and we can't expect them to pay for all their needs. Our welfare state depends on the social contract. Swedes pay a large part of their income in tax in order to get social protection and a society that works. If it doesn't work for folks outside big cities, they will rebel politically, and it won't be pretty. Let's not forget that in the U.S., when rural dwellers felt disrespected, Donald Trump became president. Our last word article this week, the in-depth piece, is titled, How It Feels to Be Obese. Every fat person pays for his weight with anger and heartache and pain, said Tommy Tomlinson. After seeing his sister die from obesity, he embarked on the fight of his life to find the man inside himself. I weigh 460 pounds. Those are the hardest words I've ever had to write. Nobody knows that number. Not my wife, not my doctor, not my closest friends. It feels like confessing a crime. The average American male weighs about 195 pounds. I'm two of those guys with a 10-year-old left over. I'm the biggest human being most people who know me have ever met or ever will. The government definition of obesity is a body mass index of 30 or more. My BMI is 60.7. My shirts are size XXXXXXL, which the big and tall stores shorten to 6X. I'm 6'1" or 73 inches tall. My waist is 60 inches around. I'm nearly a sphere. Those are the numbers. This is how it feels. I'm on the subway in New York City, standing in the aisle, clinging to the pole. I live in Charlotte, North Carolina, and I don't visit New York much, so I don't have a feel for how subway cars move. I'm praying this one doesn't lurch around a corner or slam to a stop, because I'm terrified of falling. Part of it is embarrassment. When a fat guy falls, it's hard to get up. But what really scares me is the chance I might land on somebody. My palms start to sweat, and all of a sudden I flash back to elementary school in Georgia, standing in the aisle on the school bus. The driver hollers at me to find a seat. He can't take us home until everybody sits down. I'm the only one standing. Every time I spot an open space, somebody slides to the edge of the seat and covers it up. Nobody wants the fat boy mashed in next to them. I freeze, helpless. The driver glares at me in the rearview mirror. An older kid sitting in front of me, a redhead, freckles, I'll never forget his face, has a cast on his right arm. He reaches back and starts clubbing me with it, below the waist, out of the driver's line of sight. He catches me in the groin and it hurts, but not as much as the shame when other kids laugh and the bus driver gets up and storms toward me. And the train stops and jolts me back into now. By any reasonable standard, I have won life's lottery. I grew up with two loving parents in a peaceful house. I spent my whole career doing work that thrills me, writing for newspapers and magazines. I married the best woman I've ever known, Alex Felsing, and I love her more now than when my heart first tumbled for her. We're blessed with strong families and a deep bench of friends. Our lives are full of music and laughter. I wouldn't swap with anyone. Except on those mornings when I wake up and take a long, naked look in the mirror. My body is a car wreck. Skin tags, long mole-like growths caused by chafing, dangle under my arms and down in my crotch. I have breasts where my chest ought to be. My belly is straight with more stretch marks than a mother of five. My stomach hangs below my waist, giving me what the Urban Dictionary calls a front butt, as if some twisted Dr. Frankenstein grafted an extra rear end on the wrong side. Varicose veins bulge from my thighs. My calves and shins are rust-colored and shiny from a condition called chronic venous insufficiency. Here's what it means. The veins in my legs aren't strong enough to push all the blood back up toward my heart, so it pools in my capillaries and forces little dots of iron up under my skin. The veins are failing because of the pressure caused by 460 pounds pushing downward with every step I take. My body is crumbling under its own gravity. Some days when I see that disaster staring back, I get so mad that I pound my gut with my fists as if I could beat the fat out of me. Other times the sight sinks me into a blue fog that can ruin an hour or a morning or a day. But most of the time what I feel is sadness over how much life I've wasted. When I was a kid, I never climbed a tree or learned to swim. When I was in my 20s, I never took a girl home from a bar. Now I'm 50, and I've never hiked a mountain or ridden a skateboard or done a cartwheel. I've missed out on so many adventures, so many good times, because I was too fat to try. Sometimes, when I could have tried anyway, I didn't have the courage. I've done a lot of things I'm proud of, but I've never believed I could do anything truly great because I've failed so many times at the one crucial challenge in my life. What the hell is wrong with me? What the hell is wrong with us? As I write this, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimates that 79 million American adults, 40% of women, 35% of men, qualify as obese. The obesity rate among American children is 17% and climbing. Our collective waistline laps over every boundary, age, race, gender, politics, culture. In our fractured country, we all agree on one thing: second helpings. As every fat person knows, there's no such thing as a cheap buffet. You always pay later, one way or another. Fat America comes with a devastating bill. According to government estimates, Americans pay $147 billion a year in medical costs related to obesity. That's roughly equal to the entire budget for the U.S. Army. But the money is just part of the cost. Every fat person and every fat person's family pays with anger and heartache and pain. For every one of us who can't shed the weight, there are spouses and parents and kids and friends who grieve. We carve lines in their faces. We sentence them to long years alone. I know this from experience. I also feel it like a burning knife right now, because my sister, Brenda Williams, died 7 days ago on Christmas Eve. One of the great joys in our family was getting Brenda to laugh. If somebody cracked an off-color joke, her eyes cranked open and her eyebrows flew up her forehead like a cartoon. Sometimes she let out a low cackle that tickled me even more. She and her husband, Ed Williams, had been married 43 years and raised 3 kids. Brenda was never happier than when she had a house full of the people she loved. But she didn't laugh as much the last few years. Her weight scared her and isolated her. And eventually, It killed her. Brenda was 63 and weighed well north of 200 pounds. Her feet swelled so much that she could hardly wear shoes. Her thighs cramped so bad, with so little warning, that she was afraid to drive. For years, she dealt with sores on her legs caused by the swelling. They leaked fluid and wouldn't heal. In late December, one of the sores got infected. The funeral was on my mom's 82nd birthday. She cried tears from the bottom of the ocean. She lived next door to Brenda and Ed for almost 20 years. We moved her there after she retired. She spent so many nights telling stories around Brenda and Ed's dining room table. Now she won't go back in their house. All she can see is the empty space where Brenda used to be. The infection was the official cause of Brenda's death, but her weight killed her, sure as poison. What happens when someone close to you dies? People bring food. It arrived at Brenda and Ed's house and my mom's within minutes and in great quantities. Neighbors made potato salad and pecan pie. Folks who didn't cook brought cold cuts and light bread. One of Ed's friends arranged for the Western Sizzlin' down the road to send a whole rolling cart of meat and vegetables. No matter where you stood, you were no more than 10 feet from fried chicken. I crammed everything I could onto my double-thick paper plate. The sugar and grease pushed back the grief, just for a minute or two, long enough to breathe. This is a terrible catch-22. The thing that soothes the pain prolongs it. The thing that brings me back to life pushes me closer to the grave. More than anything, I want to buy time. I want to write every story that needs to come out of me. I want to be the old retired guy with nothing to do but read books and play cards. I want to pack a bag and fill a cooler and get in the car and just ramble. I want to kiss Alex on her 80th birthday, and I want her to kiss me on mine. I want to look back and be able to say with an honest heart that my years were not wasted. Brenda's death shook me. My only sister died a terrible death from something connected to her weight. I saw what it did to the rest of us for her to leave so soon. I don't want to put my family through that again. I want all the time I can get with the people I love. Losing weight is an epping rock fight. The enemies come from all sides. The deluge of marketing telling us to eat worse and eat more. The culture that has turned food into one of the last acceptable vices. Our families and friends who want us to share in their pleasure. Our own body chemistry dragging us back to the table out of fear that we'll starve. What matters to me right now, even more than losing weight, is that I'm trying. I never tried this hard before. I am still a fat man. I will probably always be one in my head, even if I shed every pound I want to lose. But I know for sure that there is another man inside me, and I'm no longer scared to meet him. There's a ladder I want the man who walks inside me to climb. The pull-down ladder to our attic. It's rated at 250 pounds. I've never been up in the attic because I'm afraid the ladder won't hold me. Whenever we need what's up there, Christmas ornaments, winter clothes, and extension cord, Alex has to go up and get it. I'm embarrassed that there's an entire part of our house that I've never been in. I want to climb that ladder with confidence. There's a boat I want the man inside me to put in the lake. Daddy's John boat lives in our backyard. It's green aluminum and still has its Georgia registration number on the side. When I was a kid, we hauled 1,000 catfish over the side of that boat. Daddy died in 1990, and the boat hasn't been in the water since, way before then. I've always been afraid that I'm so big I'd tip it over. It needs a drain plug and a little love, but it's still strong enough to hold a normal-sized man, and maybe his beautiful wife. There's a bicycle I want the man inside me to ride. Nothing fancy. I'd be fine with one of those old man bikes with straight handlebars and a cushy seat. Our neighborhood is full of bike riders. There's a group that rides together every Tuesday night. Sometimes we sit on the porch and wave at them as they glide past our house. A rolling parade. I'm tired of watching parades. I'd like to be in a few. There's a game I want the man inside me to play. Damn, I miss basketball. It's been so long since I boxed out for a rebound or put up a shot with a hand in my face. It doesn't matter if I'm just the old guy who jacks up threes from the corner. It doesn't matter if I sprain my ankle for the 18th time. It would feel so good to be back in the game again. There's a flight I want the man inside me to take. It doesn't matter where it goes, as long as I'm in the middle seat. I want to sit there without flooding the banks of the armrests. I want the seatbelt to click around my waist with an inch or two to spare. After that, I can bitch about the middle seat like everybody else. But I'd like to sit there and feel good about it. Just once. This is from The Elephant in the Room, One Fat Man's Quest to Get Smaller in a Growing America, by Tommy Tomlinson. Couple of the health and science articles for you this week, starting with screen time could hurt kids' development. Parents who let their young children spend lots of time in front of TVs and tablets risk slowing their kids' development, a new study has warned. Researchers in Canada tracked nearly 2,500 children ages 2 to 5 and asked their mothers to report how many hours a day, on average, their child looked at screens. The moms also answered questions on their kids' communication skills, behavior, and social interactions. Researchers found that on average, the children spent 2 to 3 hours a day in front of screens. The American Academy of Pediatrics recommends that young children watch only 1 hour of quality programming a day. And the more time the children spent looking at screens at ages 2 and 3, the worse they did in developmental tests at ages 3 and 5. The study had some limitations. Most data was self-reported by the mothers, and the authors emphasize that correlation does not mean causation. But they suggest that differences in development could be because kids who bury their heads in screens miss out on opportunities to practice and refine their communication, social, and motor skills by playing with toys, for example, or interacting with family and friends. Parents can think of screen time as they do junk food, study leader Sherry Madigan from University of Calgary tells Time.com. In small doses, it's okay, but in excess, it has consequences. Monarch butterflies dying out. The western monarch butterfly may be heading for extinction, reports CNN.com. In the 1980s, up to 10 million of these beautiful insects would overwinter in California each year, having migrated from inland areas of the western U.S. But a mere 30,000 monarchs were counted in California last year. That's an 86% drop from 2017, and below the number scientists think is necessary to sustain the population. Conservationists believe the main causes of the decline are droughts brought on by climate change and habitat destruction. The acreage of milkweed, a food source and the only plant the insects lay their eggs on, has been shrinking. The nonprofit Xerxes Society, which carries out an annual Thanksgiving monarch count, notes that the drop-off has come despite extensive conservation efforts by environmental groups and state and federal agencies. If we want to have monarchs migrate through the western U.S., as they have for centuries, sustained work is needed, the organization said in a statement. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service will likely announce in June whether the monarchs should be protected under the Endangered Species Act. Looks like we've got time for one of the Talking Points articles. Abortion. Have pro-choicers gone too far? Abortion rights advocates can no longer hide behind rhetoric about choice or women's health, said John Daniel Davidson in The Federalist. Succumbing to the inescapable logic of abortion, Democrats are finally admitting that there is no difference between abortion and infanticide. The state of New York recently passed new abortion legislation that legalizes abortion after 24 weeks of pregnancy. The law states that late-term abortions will be allowed if there is an absence of fetal viability or if a single doctor determines it is necessary to protect the patient's life or health. Such intentionally vague language, of course, could be used to justify abortions up to the moment a child is born. Democrats have pushed similar legislation in other states, including Virginia, where legislators introduced a bill allowing third trimester abortions if continuing the pregnancy would impair the mental or physical health of the woman. Delegate Kathy Tran, the bill's sponsor, admitted it could conceivably allow a woman to receive an abortion while in labor. Democratic Governor Ralph Northam went even further, suggesting that babies with severe deformities could be made comfortable and left to die or killed after being born. In other words, abortion advocates believe the mother's wishes trump the child's right to life even up to and perhaps after birth. No, Democrats are not trying to legalize infanticide, said Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times. The uproar over the Virginia bill began after a Republican legislator floated a hypothetical question. Could a woman about to go into labor request an abortion if her doctor certified that she needed one for mental health reasons? Tran responded poorly, but the question itself was ludicrous. No doctor would ever approve an abortion while a woman was in labor. Only about a dozen physicians in the United States even perform late-term abortions, which represent about 1% of all terminations. Nobody gets a third-term abortion for the hell of it, said Sarah Jones in New York Magazine. Not only are they painful and expensive, they often happen under tragic circumstances involving severe deformities in wanted pregnancies. The real outrage is that conservatives would demand that a woman endure a full pregnancy and labor, knowing the baby would die shortly after birth. If Democrats think late-term abortions are a tragedy, said Ashley McGuire in USA Today, why did they just give them a standing ovation? Lawmakers cheered raucously at the passage of New York's abortion law, with Governor Andrew Cuomo lighting up Manhattan's One World Trade Center pink in celebration. But seeing Democrats vigorously applaud abortion for 7-pound babies makes most Americans queasy. A recent Gallup poll shows only 13% support abortion into third trimester. The reality of late-term abortions doesn't match up with pro-choice rhetoric, said Alexandra DeSantis in The Atlantic. Research from the pro-abortion rights Guttmacher Institute has found that instead of facing medical conditions, most women who seek late abortions are young, poor, or both, and delayed the procedure because they had to find money to pay for the abortion. Today, fetuses have been able to survive outside the womb as early as 21 weeks. Pro-choice radicals might be able to justify killing viable babies, but most people, even those who favor some abortion access, instinctively recoil from what they see. There are plenty of legitimate reasons that a woman might want or need an abortion later in her pregnancy, said Christina Cotterucci in Slate.com. Legal restrictions championed by conservatives are one of them. Mandatory waiting periods, ultrasound laws, clinic closures, and insurance restrictions make it more likely that desperate women will be denied first trimester abortions and forced into late-term abortions that Republicans claim to abhor. But the anti-choice crowd isn't interested in making abortion access easier. They'd rather seize on extremely rare cases and demonize women and doctors confronting agonizing real-world choices. New York's new law should serve as a wake-up call to pro-life conservatives, said Sarah Quinlan in TheBulwark.com. Even if the Supreme Court overturns Roe, abortion will remain legal in many states. It is simply not possible to eliminate abortion by legislating it away. Rather than using divisive rhetoric that paints women who have abortions as murderers, pro-life organizations should focus on ensuring that reliable contraception is widely available and on giving pregnant women enough emotional and tangible support so that abortion doesn't feel like their only or best option. If we truly want to end abortion and convince Americans that a baby in the womb is a human being, the pro-life movement must focus on changing the culture. And a short note or two. President Trump has spent about 60% of his workday over the past 3 months in unstructured executive time, according to leaked private schedules. The president spends most of that time in his residence watching TV, reading newspapers, and making phone calls to pals and advisors. He usually takes his first official meeting of the day after 11 a.m., and on most days has only 2 or 3 hours of official duties. We'll wrap up today's show with a quote from Oprah Winfrey, quoted in the New York Post. She says, "One of the hardest things in life to learn are which bridges to cross and which ones to burn." With that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it, and please be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.